1 Samuel 16. We're going to look at the first 13 verses. The Lord said to Samuel, "How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse, the Bethlehemite, for I have provided for myself a king among his sons." And Samuel said, "How can I go? If Saul hears it, he will kill me." And the Lord said, "Take a heifer with you and say, 'I have come to sacrifice to the Lord,' and invite Jesse to the sacrifice, and I will show you what you shall do. You shall anoint for me him whom I declare to you." Samuel did what the Lord commanded and came to Bethlehem. The elders of the city came to meet him trembling and said, "Do you come peaceably?" And he said, "Peaceably, I have come to sacrifice to the Lord. Consecrate yourselves and come with me to the sacrifice." And he consecrated Jesse and his sons and invited them to the sacrifice. When they came, he looked on Eliab and thought, "Surely the Lord's anointed is before him." But the Lord said to Samuel, "Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart." Then Jesse called Abinadab and made him pass before Sam. And he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." Then Jesse made Shema pass by. And he said, "Neither has the Lord chosen this one." And Jesse made seven of his sons pass before Samuel. And Samuel said to Jesse, "The Lord has not chosen these." Then Samuel said to Jesse, "Are all your sons here?" And he said, "There remains yet the youngest, but behold, he is keeping the sheep." And Samuel said to Jesse, "Send and get him, for we will not sit down until he comes." And he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and had beautiful eyes and was handsome. And the Lord said, "Arise, anoint him, for this is he." And then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers. And the Spirit of the Lord rushed upon David from that day forward. And Samuel rose up and went to Ramah. This is the word of God. We are, like maybe many of you, tracking through a show as a family right now. And this might not make a whole lot of sense to you, maybe. Because of the way we consume these days, it's funny. There is a show that, just building up until last night, the drama has been crazy. And so for the past maybe 6 or 7 or 8 episodes, what they decided to do is build into the beginning of each episode a sort of highlight reel. This is what happened previous, if you were not able to either follow along and you didn't get to see the last episode, or if you grew up before the age of binging and this goes back to weeks and you forget what the show was actually about weeks ago. Now it's kind of hard for us to do this because we already just watched 4 episodes and we're watching the 5th. And so we know what happens, and so we skip it. But I feel like in order to get the drama of what is going on in this passage, we need just that. To just go over just very quickly what the storyline has been over the past few weeks. Because chapter 16 takes a huge, massive turn. This ball that just has been hit on the green is slicing like crazy. This is a big curveball. So going back and just collecting a bit of the story, Israel has been demanding a king, just like the other nations, and they have been doing this in an unrelenting way. I mean, in the way that the children... "Mommy, please, can we have it? Mommy, please, can we have it? Mommy, please, can we have it? Mommy, please, can we have it?" "Fine, just shut your mouth and you can get it. I'll give it to you." Maybe with a little more love, that's sort of what the Lord does. He gives them the king after this unrelenting, unexhausting, just demand over and over again. Saul is the king that they have been asking for, and Saul is the king they get. He is a specimen of a man, a head and shoulders above everyone else. The text literally says he is the most handsome in all of Israel. He is built like the rock, probably without steroids. He immediately takes the reins and he leads Israel into battle against the Ammonites. and he defeats them. He does exactly what he's supposed to do. So much so that Samuel actually bids farewell. He kind of goes, all right, my job is done. I did what I was supposed to do. I am sort of the last of the judges. I might still continue in my prophetic ways, but the king has arrived. He's here. I can, in a sense, go home. Israel is saved. They now have a hero king. After the dust clears, it's time for Saul to lead Israel to war against the hated Philistines. They have a very quick win, and then Saul chooses to disobey by sacrificing unlawfully. Well, right after this, they win again against the Philistines. And it's right after the win that Saul makes a rash vow, hamstringing the entire army and almost killing his son. Almost murdering his son. Saul follows this up with even more disobedience. The Lord told him to devote the Amalekites to destruction. And we know, because we've just saw this episode last week, that instead what he does is he lets the king live, and he chooses to allow all of the best in the land to survive and go to the people. By this point, God has had enough. He's done. He's ready to move on. It's time to anoint a new king. And we hear, going all the way back to 1 Samuel 13:14, this is nothing new. He is going to choose somebody that's after God's own heart. The drama rises to new heights because Saul in this moment is not dead. They don't need to look for another king because Saul is ably reigning on the throne. Samuel, in obeying God, causes some major issues here. First, he stirs up quite a frenzy in Bethlehem by just showing up. Everybody's on edge. Samuel's here. What possibly is wrong? And then he becomes complicit in a scheme of intrigue to send everyone off the scent by simply doing his job, conducting a worship service, so that he can commit treason. This is a pretty cool chapter. We find in this story that although Samuel does everything that God asks him to do, he's obedient. Every step of the way, he's obedient. Samuel and God are not on the same page. He's obedient, but they're not on the same page. They don't see eye to eye. Samuel is interpreting everything with his own eyes, with his own vision, with his own limited vision. Instead of truly trusting God, his omniscience, his all-seeing eye, his plan, Samuel has some lessons to learn here, and that's really what I want to focus in on, is this wrestling match between limited vision and God's vision, or eternal vision. Samuel's limited vision really causes some faulty expectations. There are faulty fears that he goes through, that he wrestles with, that he works with, and frankly, just stereotypes that shouldn't exist, that are unnecessary and even sinful because of the fact that he just can't see as far as maybe he should see, or he doesn't see the way God sees. And so we begin with this idea of faulty experiences. And if you go back to the very first verse of the chapter, I don't want to miss this. It's vital to the story. Look at verse 1 again. It says, "The Lord said to Samuel, 'How long will you grieve over Saul, since I have rejected him from being king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and go. I will send you to Jesse in Bethlehem, for I've provided for myself a king among his sons.'" Do you see what the text is inferring about Samuel here? That he is moping around. That he is, in a sense, stuck in his apartment, sort of pacing, having no clue what to do. Do you see, from his perspective, the grand experiment has already failed. Israel's kingship, Saul might not be dead, but the kingship is dead. This whole thing, was it a waste of time? Whatever is Israel going to do? I could even see Saul thinking already, this quick, I have to get back to my job. I just told everybody farewell, and now I'm going to have to come back to work. He was thinking that Saul was the best man for the job. Did you not see this guy? He was a specimen. Men wanted to be him. Women wanted to be with him. He proved that he was a warrior. He was a leader. Israel was supposed to wipe out all of their enemies. He was supposed to be the savior. Now Samuel is thinking that this is the beginning of the end. I don't know about you, but I tend to think this way all the time. I'm told often in my house that I'm a bit overdramatic, and my nickname is Mr. Hollywood. I know any of you that know me would completely disagree with that. I'm not. I don't blow anything out of proportion. But in thinking very personally about this, I went back to a time when it was about 2008, and Jill and I were, well, Corbin was about 6 months old now, and everything in Pennsylvania was falling apart. Everything. There was no storyline for us anymore. We tried everything to stay there, and there was just nothing. And so we decide to move down to Concord, where my parents are, and I have an amazing lead on a job. In fact, I have a job that I'm ready to start. We're all packed and ready to go and excited for adventure. Everything was lined up and planned, and prayer went into this and all of it. I mean, we were just ready to start new, fresh, down here. I would be overseeing the restaurants. Actually, this is a few years ago. Now you have to use your imagination because it looks nothing like it did. But down at the Epicenter, and I was going to manage for the company and for my boss just all of the restaurants that were a part of that business. And the day we moved down, the Epicenter declared bankruptcy. And everything, again, fell apart in our lives. Absolutely everything. We were sharing in my parents' house one of those beds, you know, that you tuck the one bed under the other bed, and we pulled it out every night, and we that's what we ended up having to sleep on in one of their smaller rooms, and we had no clue what we were going to do, and I have to admit, I was pretty much freaking out. I thought it was the beginning of the end. I was almost done. There was despair and helplessness, and now just this idea of, what now? You've had these moments in your life, I'm sure. And so what does God tell Samuel to do? Does he sit there and mope with him? Does he sit there and try to encourage him? I love the text. He goes, how long are you going to grieve? Get up. I have a job for you. Grab your horn. And what's neat about the text, about this verse, is not only that he says, how long are you going to sit here and grieve? How long are you going to sit here and mope? Get up and get back to work. But he says this near the end, I will send you to Jesse. And then it says this, for I have provided for myself. That word provided is actually the idea that God sees for himself an answer. I love that. You see, where Samuel saw nothing except the end and heartache and despair and brokenness and what now? God sees a plan. He has the answer. It's all about to be worked out. In fact, when Samuel thinks it's the beginning of the end, God is just getting started. And at least for that portion of our life, boy, even into the right now today as I stand before you, in many ways, that was the beginning of our life when we moved down here. And there were so many things that we saw God orchestrate and move to where I'm even standing before you today. It's unbelievable. But as if the expectations aren't enough, then we have the second come in, the faulty fear. And fear always comes with the expectations, especially broken expectations, right? Typically what ends up happening is you don't gird up your loins. You don't You don't flex and say, okay, bring it. What's next? Instead, you do mope. And you know what? You almost become immobile. You know why? Because you tend to be gripped with fear. You don't know what to do next. And this is Samuel's problem. And you can see that it's probably validated. Verse 2. We go right from expectations into fear. Look at it. It says, and Samuel said, this is how he responds to God. How can I go? Are you crazy? Don't you see what's happening around me? Okay, the text doesn't see that if you're looking down. I'm just sort of embellishing a little. How can I go? Saul is king. Have you seen him? He's a bit prideful. He cares a bit about his kingship, about his position. If Saul hears it, he will kill me. There won't be another thought in his mind. And I love the Lord here. He says, okay, take a heifer with you and say, I've come to sacrifice to the Lord. It's kind of a pain in the butt, isn't it? But God always seems to have a fix. This new plan is fraught with danger and a whole bunch of unknowns. And I don't want you to just miss over that. How hard this would have been for Samuel, I don't have words. Very honestly, I've never experienced something like this. This kind of intrigue, it's never been a part of my life. This is pretty intense. Samuel questions God. You've really put me in a pickle. That's a fun saying. You've put me in a pickle. I have no clue where that comes from. If you Google it, most people don't know where it comes from. But you know what it means, right? Heck, I don't even like to be around pickles, frankly. They smell bad. I don't think they taste very good. But it's the idea of being in a hard situation, being stuck in the middle. Kids, you know what that's like, right? Being in a pickle. Boy, the paper's due and you're not ready. The test is here and you didn't prepare the way you should have. You're in a pickle. God is the one that put Samuel in a pickle. Samuel was doing everything God asked him to do. And he's like, are you crazy? There's no way. I'm not sure you understand the weight of the situation. You are literally asking me to commit treason. Saul was your guy. You picked him, not me. I think it is really cool that God's the one that devises this plan. I mean, you almost get the picture that God, in a certain sense, and without being disrespectful at all, puts his arm around him and just goes, I got a way we can. Nobody will ever know this is coming. All I need you to do is just do your job. Just go and conduct a worship service and nobody will have a clue. Nobody will know. The plan works really well. In fact, we see in the text that the leaders were very nervous when he shows up. And rightfully so for all kinds of reasons. First and foremost, just because of his stature. This is a small little town, really means nothing. And all of a sudden, Samuel shows up. Who else is he going to bring? Why is he here? He just, I don't know if the news traveled or if many people there even witnessed the chapter before. And that was the fact that Samuel scolds the king. He doesn't like the idea that he left the enemy king alive. And so you know what he does? He's the one that slashes him to pieces. Oh man, why are you here? He's like, don't worry about it. We're just here for a worship service. We'll sanctify y'all. Y'all can be a part of it. It'd be great. Again, what we see here is something that we might not, on a normal basis, from day to day, week to week, year to year, we might not be very welcome of this idea, but God's plans are typically not the simplest, are they? God doesn't have most of us live our lives in a straight shot with all of the exits marked out for rest. In a real perfect kind of way, does he? He typically takes roads that aren't paved, takes us through cornfields and over rivers and through dense woods. And I tried to change the wording a little bit just so you didn't think we were going to grandma's house. But what's funny is I did even look up that song. And what's interesting about the song is the idea that they can't wait to get to grandma's house and how awesome it's going to be for Thanksgiving. But what a journey. The journey is not fun. We're freezing cold. The journey is long and scary. And so we can't wait for the journey to be over and finally be at grandma's house. You see, God, he needs us to understand that our ways, that what we see, that our vision is very, very, very nearsighted all the time. All the time. Our vision is impaired. And therefore, what has to happen? We have to trust God. Typically, the greater the lesson, the more it means, the more dramatic the episode. Can you think of a dramatic episode in your life? God always has purpose. And so he walks you through that with all that pain, all that suffering. And what are you thinking to yourself? I can't wait to get to grandma's house. And God's like, slow down. You need to learn this. This is vitally important. First and foremost, because I love you. And then second of all, because I have a job for you. I have a mission for you. If it's nothing more than Christ-likeness, that's enough. But for us, it's usually two-headed. It's that along with the idea that he wants to take all that he's put you through and shape you and mold you so that you can be used. But that's not it. Yes, the plan works like a charm. No one suspects a thing. Samuel was free to meet with Jesse and his sons, which brings us really to the last lesson. There is this idea that Samuel's vision is really not great. He struggles with his expectations, and then he piles on fear, but he's still not done. What he does then is he tries to find a cure for his fear, but again, he uses his own vision. So what he does is he tacks on all kinds of stereotypes that really just are not good. Look at verses 6 and 7. And we could probably read this whole passage of all the sons. But look at these two verses. When they came, he looked on Eliab. And he thought, and I'm sure he thought to himself. And you could just, you picture this, right? Samuel is standing there. Jesse finally brings his sons. The oldest comes. And yeah, he's not Saul, but he's close. He could at least maybe go a few rounds with Saul, right? And the eyes widen and he smiles probably for the first time in a couple weeks and his chest pops out again and he thinks there's hope. And he goes, okay, I get it. Here he is. Here's the man. Surely the Lord's anointed is before him. But the Lord said to Samuel, there's this voice in the back of his head that goes, nope, not him. Do not look on his appearance or on the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For the Lord sees not as man sees. Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And you're probably thinking, or at least Samuel is thinking, oh, great. What's coming? Okay, so Samuel was looking for Saul's replacement. His limited vision saw all the strengths of Saul, thought that his replacement needed all the same attributes, height and build and strength and charisma, that he's sure of himself, that he walks into a room and owns it, all these things and many more. He didn't quite get it. Up until this point, God in his mercy gave Israel and even Samuel what they thought they wanted. And we talked about this. We've talked about this for weeks. A king like the nations. A man's man by human standards. Again, just quick little bunny trail. Be very careful what you ask from the Lord. Because if you don't match up, if your heart does not match up with his, if your vision is not as good as his, and you like a child, Lord, please, you don't understand. I need this. I have to have it. In his mercy, you know what he often does? He gives it to you. And it just ruins everything in your life. It makes you miserable. That's ultimately what Saul did, what this kingship, at least a man's man by human standards, does for Israel and for Samuel and for everyone. It ruins everything. But God's vision is very different than man's. All the attributes that man considers important are not worthless, but they pale in comparison to the posture of the heart. So much so that God works through the dramatic again so that Samuel can finally learn this point. And with a Cinderella-like air, there's a procession of able candidates. Who would the glass slipper fit? each of Jesse's sons, with chests puffed up and in their best attire, come next and go, I bet it's me. Oh, I get to be king. I'm going to be king. This is going to be awesome. They present themselves to Samuel, and none of them are worthy. You just picture God ticking them off. Nope. 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 The shoe doesn't fit any of them. Jesse, are there any others? Anybody else? Oh, yeah. I do have one more. He's the youngest. He's out tending the sheep. Almost forgot about him. The text is great here because he is the youngest. The Hebrew word that we have here is actually the smallest. He is the one that they wouldn't have thought about. He is, as some commentators just kind of tongue-in-cheek like to say, is the runt of the bunch. Whoever picks the runt, you don't pick the runt. God's in the business of picking runts. So, Samuel goes, we're not resting. We're not even going to leave this room. We're all standing here until somebody runs and gets David. And so you could imagine the anxiety, you could imagine the awkwardness, the waiting as the sons, the rest of the sons stand around and are talking about what's going on. Really? They didn't pick you? How did they not pick the oldest son? We fought all the time. I'm the strongest. I can't believe that. Just back and forth. Jesse's probably pacing like crazy, trying to, what is going on? Seriously, what is happening here? And then all of a sudden, in their anxiety and their awkward, this awkward silence, if it is, with all of this murmuring, all of a sudden somebody comes busting through the door and he's sweating and he's probably sunburnt. He's tired. And God goes, there he is. That's the guy. I'm going to use him. It's like, at least go shower first. Now, I understand, and I'm not going to be able to have, I don't have time to spend on this. But the text is clear that David was not ugly, that he was not weak, but his appearance was not overwhelming the way it was with Saul. And what's amazing is, just to set this off, and again, a little bunny trail here, when we first learn about Saul, the first thing we learn is about his strength, his family's money, and how beautiful he is, or how handsome he is. Really, at the end of the day, are those the things that you want to be the first, second, and third that come up as far as who you are as a person? I don't know. Kind of brings up one other situation in my life. I remember this time in Colorado when I was still living out there and I was single. And I went out initially to do some ministry there, and I was sort of done with that role. And I was looking for another job. And life was expensive out in Colorado, even back then. And I was a little nervous. I really needed to find a job. And up till that point, I taught school. And I was a youth pastor, and I was doing a bunch of other things at the time. And there were two kids in my classes that I was teaching, and their mom happened to be, just got hired to be the president of the Chamber of Commerce there in Denver. And she came up to me after she knew that I was done with the job, that I was leaving, and she asked me if I had a job. And I told her no, that I was looking, and I would love for her, if she had any opportunities, to let me know. And so the way that conversation turned was that she told me that she wanted me to be hired on within the month and to be her vice president of the Denver Chamber of Commerce. And I looked at her and I said, I don't even know what that job means. How do you expect me to do it? And she looked at me with this huge smile and she goes, I hear you have a master's degree, so maybe you can write a little. She goes, after that, I've been looking for somebody that doesn't know anything. And I was like, yeah, way to encourage me. I'm super pumped. I can't wait to start. But the idea was, is that what she wanted to do was, she wanted somebody who had maybe, yes, some writing skills, and she knew that I had some people skills. And after that, she wanted to be able to teach me everything else and maybe mold me. She didn't want somebody that thought they knew everything. How often do we think that we need to pad our resumes? That we actually need to change who we are before we enter into service for God. We need to take classes. We need to learn formal apologetics. We need to become more credible. Maybe we do whatever it takes to even look better. Maybe we start hitting the gym so we have a little something to back up our words. Maybe it's just learning the latest fads and learning the world better so we can talk about it. And, I've seen that movie and that show and I know that band and now I have more credibility. Do you ever feel like the very least likely candidate to do anything for the kingdom of God? This line of thinking, even this question, is incredibly short-sighted. The vision is impaired. Do you see, I really truly believe that God would rather have your heart than all of the skills, abilities, resumes, and stature that you could even begin to muster. God would rather have a broken man and a broken woman who has a heart for him. God would use David to not only build a kingdom, but an eternal dynasty. Hopefully, after this experience, Samuel learned to see a little clearer what God sees. That we are to trust God's vision and not our own. Samuel really only had to wait, we're not told per se, but maybe what, an afternoon to meet David? Israel would wait about another 1,000 years before Christ comes on the scene. You see, God, he's amazing, isn't he? I mean, really, truly. He is so far-seeing. His vision is so clear. Of course it is. He's written the whole story. But it's so far-seeing that the introduction to David is this, and the stories that follow are simply a foreshadow that's set up for the son of David, the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. You see, King David wasn't even the answer to Israel's real problems, and we know all about David, don't we? Yes, he had a man after God's own heart, but was it perfect? Not even close. Some of the sins that he committed, most of us would never even think about committing. They were pretty rough. King David may have done a lot of things right, but he was merely nothing but a signpost. Something that we are to look at that points us to the true king. Somebody who's able to really truly save Israel and save us. And so just as Samuel was to learn to see God, God's way, we're to do the same. And frankly, that's my encouragement this morning. Oh, I think, though, just as an encouragement, we have one better. Paul, actually, we don't know if Paul wrote it or not. It's found in Hebrews, so actually, we're not quite sure if Paul wrote it or not. There's a lot of good reason to say that he didn't. But the author to the Hebrews says that really what we are to do as followers of Christ is not to trust our own vision, but to actually fix our gaze, the text says, to fix our gaze on the author and perfecter of our faith. We have Jesus. We have one that lived on this earth. We have books written about him. We are able to not trust in our own limited vision because we are able to see him so clearly through the power of the Spirit. And I think what we need to do is just be a little more expectant of him, because he will show up in dramatic ways and he will disrupt your life. He will cause all kinds of problems. But those problems will all work themselves out for your good. And just like Samuel, to teach us to lay down our expectations, to lay down our fears, to lay down our stereotypes, and second, to really give us eyes like Jesus. Or if nothing else, to help us to have the faith to trust what Jesus sees and not what we see.